We're going on a journey back to a unique era of broadcasting in Ireland, time when pirates ruled the airwaves. We're tuning into the 1980s. Hello, I'm Russell, or Russ Padmore. This is the second episode of my analysis of the impact of pirate radio in the Northwest during the 1980s. I'll explain how unlicensed broadcasters became profit-making enterprises, creating jobs when the Irish economy was struggling as the nation was deep in debt.
The backdrop to the 1980s was atrocious, with very high unemployment, high inflation, very weak economic growth, and very significant outward migration.
The owner of a Donegal-based pirate station gives his first ever radio interview. Paddy Simpson reveals how he targeted listeners in Northern Ireland.
The Protestant population in Northern Ireland loved country music. There were pirate stations, but at the time the government had no will to close them down.
And Daniel O'Donnell tells me pirates made him famous, and he wasn't worried about being on air on an illegal radio station.
Never entered my head. I never even thought about it. But, you know, what harm was it doing? It was actually providing a service that was not there.
I was one of the pioneers of pirate radio in Ireland. In the 1980s, I owned KTOK, a radio station in Donegal town. I managed NWCR in Buncrana, where I also presented a programme, and I was a disc jockey on broadcasters in Waterford and Mullingar. From 1985, my voice was familiar to tens of thousands of radio listeners across the Northwest. The first pirate radio stations in Donegal in the early 1980s were started by enthusiastic amateurs. Sometimes they broadcast for just a few days from festivals. They were not operating as organised businesses and didn't have regular programmes, but they did influence others to start broadcasting. Malachy O'Doherty, a political commentator and author, presented news on a short-lived pirate radio station in South Donegal.
I worked on a little station called Donegal Community Radio. I discovered it in 1980. It was at the top of the hill in Mount Charles. That's about 4 miles from Donegal town. There was an old stone shed there, and I don't know what it was used for at all. So essentially you just went up the steps into the upper area, and these were the stone steps on the outside, and you find yourself in this room where people had set up a desk with a microphone and turntable. And my job was to read the news twice a day, midday and I think 6 o'clock in the evening, with a prepared news report. And I got my news just from reading the morning papers and from listening to other radio stations.
And you moved on from Mount Charles to another local unlicensed station based in Letterkenny, but that didn't work out well. Please tell us more.
What happened at Donegal Community Radio was I turned up one day and the turntable was turning and just clicking because the record on it had come to the end. There was nobody around and I thought, goodness, what's happened here? What had happened was there'd been a storm in the night and the transmitter had been damaged. So we were off air. That was it. It was over and done with. But they told me about another station that was running in Letterkenny. And so I went to Letterkenny to meet some guys there. And they were very, very conscientious, very serious guys. They were not offering very much money. And they were offering me accommodation in a rattly old caravan at the top of the mountain. And you know what Letterkenny's like. This was autumn. This was coming into winter. And my accommodation was going to be this freezing caravan. So I let that opportunity pass. It really was a haphazard, amateurish effort. And I think people were just feeling their way. And, you know, you came later and you ran stations and you had a sense of purpose and direction. You know, I got the feeling these people were just thinking, you know, here's a technology that's come available. Let's have a go and see what happens.
Malachy O'Doherty, an author and political commentator. In the early 80s, before stations like NWCR in Buncrana or KTOK in Donegal town, radio in the region was very much an amateur operation. Tommy Rosny, a disc jockey and enthusiast of country music, did his first broadcast on pirate stations in Letterkenny.
First radio station I worked for was Radio Donegal. It was run by two lads, Richard Crowley and Jerome Keeney from Letterkenny. They were going to start off a local radio station in Letterkenny in late 1980-81. And they were looking for DJs, and they said, anybody interested, make a wee demo. Just play yourself introducing records.
That was 81. Describe what the radio station was, or how it was run, how often it was on air.
Well, it was on about 8 or 9 hours a day. I used to finish work in Dunn's, and I was on air at 6:30 until 8, playing music. And for the first 2 or 3 weeks, we were only doing a test broadcast, but then we started going on the air in the morning from around 8 o'clock in the morning till around maybe 12 o'clock at night.
So this was Radio Donegal, based in Letterkenny. How wide was the signal going?
It was only about 5 or 6 miles. It had basically done Letterkenny out to maybe Newton Cunningham.
So this would be 1981, a very limited station. How long did it stay on air?
We were on air from around 1981 to around maybe 1984. Two other lads came into Letterkenny and they started up another local radio station.
Which station was that?
Radio Donegal as well. It was a different one, you know. It was two brothers from, I think they were from County Tyrone, the O'Neill brothers they were called. It only went for a short while.
I know without doubt that radio became more professional, certainly by the mid-80s. It was a dramatic change, wasn't it?
That's right. In 1986 then, I started with DCR. It was owned by Bobby McDade from Letterkenny. He was a businessman in Letterkenny, and Paddy Simpson would have had a hand in it too. That's when I used to do 5 nights a week, and I used to do a Sunday as well. It was more professional.
So radio stations were basing themselves in premises in the town centre. They were suddenly very visible compared to radio stations hidden away in a barn. Why do you think the stations became much more professional and much more sustainable operations?
The presenters that were on there in the mid-80s, they had started earlier on, and they kind of got more experienced at what broadcasting was, and one or two of the lads who had started it, you know, knew a little bit about radio. And the more you did it, the more experience. When I started off, I was raw. I was just playing tapes, and you were kind of self-taught. The more you did it, the more experience you got at it.
Why do you think country music was more popular on stations in rural Ireland?
A lot of people who would be tuned into you were out in farmland areas, and they used to go to the dances, like in Letterkenny. You'd have had the Fiesta, you might have had Frankie's and Rafoe, and every Saturday night it was a country band era. I know it was just kind of coming near the end of the show band era, but country music was popular all around the country. And like Dublin would have been more a kind of a pop. People in the city would have been more into the pop. They wouldn't have been into country, whereas out in all the counties around Ireland, they were all into the country music.
Oh, we love the pirate stations. We love the pirate stations.
The first pirate stations in the Northwest didn't last long. But by the time I was managing and presenting programmes on NWCR in Buncrana in 1985, broadcasting had become a more organised and lucrative business.
Five-star, great name for a group. System Addicts, right here at your favourite station, NWCR, where the time is, well, 4:07. Good afternoon. Welcome into the Ross Padmore Glass Cave, where it all happens every weekday afternoon and early evening between 4 and 6.
I recall at Christmas, in some hours, we spent more time airing advertisements than playing music. We soon had competition from other full-time radio stations. The airwaves of the Northwest offered listeners several choices of local stations, like other regions of the country. John Horgan is an academic in Dublin who studied the history of the media in Ireland.
We had become accustomed over the years to a fairly monochrome broadcasting spectrum, both in television and in radio. And the upsurge of pirate radio, as it was then, was greeted with incomprehension, I would say, at first by the professionals, resistance secondly, and then a sort of a grudging acceptance that this phenomenon was here to stay and would have to be accommodated somehow. It was the government's job to deal with it. And the state broadcasting apparatus and organisation, RTE as it was, knew very well, instinctively, that this was a huge threat, A, to its monopoly, and B, of course, to its income stream.
Was there a major difference between the unlicensed stations in the big population areas in the country, whether it's Dublin or Cork or perhaps even Galway, compared to the radio stations operating in rural Ireland?
A huge difference. First of all, of course, there were many more pirate stations in the big urban areas. There were even one or two very unusual ones. There was one in the west of Ireland in Galway, founded by people who were passionate supporters of the Irish language. And so this broadcast a mixture of cultural material and highly critical political material, which meant that it was among the very few pirate stations that were actively singled out by the legislators, or more particularly by the police and by the broadcasting authorities, for negative attention of a high order. And equipment would have been seized and destroyed more often there. There were also one or two very briefly flourishing radio stations. Again, I can think more in the west of Ireland, maybe in the Midlands, broadcast on, broadly speaking, Republican lines. You know, we must have a united Ireland, and the sooner the better. And that did tend to attract much more negative feedback from the state and from its agencies than the ones that were simply broadcasting music and a few local advertisements and hoping to get away with it.
I'm thinking of stations in rural areas like the Northwest, for example. Did they create a platform linking small communities in the Irish countryside that might not have been linked in the same way before?
One of the ways that they created an incredible sense of local belonging was in the broadcasting of the death notices from the local newspapers.
The media landscape was changed significantly, surely.
The local newspapers, many of whom, of which were of very high quality, saw this as a huge threat to their income streams and didn't quite know what to do about it.
Media historian Professor John Horgan. Basically, it was illegal to broadcast without a licence, but the government didn't have a structure in place to give permission for privately owned broadcasters. The National Airwaves belonged to the state-owned radio and television service RTE, which had no serious Irish competition until the pirates went on air. The government planned to introduce a licensing system, but political differences delayed legislation for years, and that created an unusual legal situation, where the authorities basically allowed the pirates to continue broadcasting. Over the years, many unlicensed stations gained bigger audiences, which in turn attracted more advertising, and many became lucrative businesses during the 80s. Pirates in border counties from Donegal to Louth were taking audiences away from the BBC and Belfast-based Downtown Radio. Paddy Simpson is a successful entrepreneur with businesses ranging from a hotel in Belfast to a cinema in Derry. In the 1980s, he owned two pirate radio stations in Donegal, notably Radio North, which was aimed at audiences in Northern Ireland. He's never spoken to the media before about his experiences of running an unlicensed radio station. But in this exclusive interview, Paddy Simpson talks for the first time about pirate radio in the Northwest during the 1980s.
Our target really wasn't any showing. Our target was Northern Ireland. The Protestant population in Northern Ireland love country music, and we saw End of the CR as looking after the north of Donegal, and we saw an opening in the north of Ireland for this.
How much was your decision to get into the media business influenced by what you could see all over Ireland? Radio stations, okay, they're unlicensed, they were on air already, enjoying success, even though they were effectively pirate stations.
Yeah, they were pirate stations, but at the time the government had no will to close them down and no desire to close them down as long as you kept your frequency clean. You always knew there was going to come a day where they would be licensed, but while we were operating, they were quite profitable.
So you had no fear of breaking the law then, as it would have been at the time?
No fear of breaking the law, because it was common practice in Ireland at the time.
Your station in Carndonagh in Inishowen, in the north of Donegal, that target audience, would it have been a lucrative business by gaining an audience along that causeway coast in Northern Ireland? Remember, at the time, there was very limited listenership of other stations anyway.
Yeah, they only had the BBC, and we just saw the appetite for for country music, gospel music, and we were aiming at a particular audience, and it was very successful.
Would you say businesses saw the opportunity to advertise and it would add to their business through the promotion of commercials on these pirate or unlicensed stations?
Yeah, at the time we had very good advertising revenue. Sometimes we were full of ads. You might have to wait a week to get on, and it was quite good, yeah, quite good. The gospel music as well, we'd done a gospel show. I'm nearly sure it was 3 days a week. We'd done a gospel show, and that enhanced the audience from that area a lot.
As we speak, we're sitting in a cinema in Derry. Mm-hmm. I've always thought of you as a serial entrepreneur. You are involved in hotels in Belfast. You have a bowling alley here in Derry, this cinema complex as well. Do you think you learned lessons from the radio business in the 80s in particular, which apply to business today?
Yeah, well, I suppose all business is the same. I mean, you take in more than you spend, and that leaves you with a profit. We went for the license for the station in Donegal, didn't get it, but I suppose maybe that was lucky, because with the advent of Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, I mean, the advertising market's totally changed.
Years ago in the 80s, when the pirate radio stations were operating, they were adding to the places people could hear music. But today there's an awful lot of places to get music beyond radio.
Yeah, I remember that time you used to go into a shop and you'd be listening to the radio to see whose station they were listening to, and you'd get a wee bit annoyed in your head if they weren't listening to yours. I suppose in Donegal they were more listening to NWCR than Radio North, but then you went into shops in Northern Ireland and they were listening to yours and give you a wee bit of pride.
Do you think the commercial station at the time in Belfast, which would have been Downtown Radio or the BBC, were worried about the popularity of the pirates back then?
Oh, I would definitely say so. I remember a Presbyterian sort of haulage company coming to me one time. They approached me to sponsor the gospel show, and I suppose they were good Christian people. They gave us 30,000, which was a lot of money in the 80s, to sponsor the gospel show, and that was satisfying a particular audience.
Businessman Paddy Simpson, an investor in pirate radio in the 1980s. You're listening to A History of Pirate Radio in the Northwest in the 1980s. Still to come, Daniel O'Donnell says the pirates linked communities on both sides of the border.
I was on a television show. I was asked about the troubles in the north. I says, well, you know, when I am on stage, I cannot tell if somebody is a Catholic or a Protestant. And the music is uniting, not dividing. And likewise radio.
From amateur beginnings and a few failures, by the 1980s, unlicensed broadcasters in border areas like Donegal were profitable businesses, creating jobs in an era that was bleak for the Irish economy. As Antishuk Charles Hockey told the country in a national State of the Nation broadcast at the start of the decade.
I wish to talk to you this evening about the state of the nation's affairs. And the picture I have to paint is not, unfortunately, a very cheerful one. As a community, we are living way beyond our means.
Austin Hughes is a financial commentator and former chief economist with KBC Bank in Dublin. He remembers how pirate radio was a breath of fresh air when the Irish economy was sailing through stormy waters.
A disastrous time for the Irish economy. The backdrop, you know, of the economy to the 1980s was atrocious, with very high unemployment, high inflation, very weak economic growth, and very significant outward migration. In fact, you know, Ireland was probably the last country in Western Europe suffering net outward migration into the early 90s as a result of the poor economic performance of the 1980s.
Did those pirate radio stations on air during the 80s actually become significant businesses against this bleak economic backdrop of the economy? They were creating jobs, after all.
They offered an alternative. They were a new voice sounding to younger people in the Irish economy, an alternative to the establishment voice of official radio stations. They were something that were seen, you know, both as providing maybe an alternative view of what was going on, an alternative rhythm.
Now, of course, I remember that there were dozens of radio stations in Dublin and right across the country, of course. Many of these unlicensed stations were on air, particularly in border areas, notably Donegal. So what kind of impact would the unlicensed radio stations have had on the economy of Northern Ireland, would you say? Because obviously they had huge audiences there.
Well, again, they would have been very important, you know, in terms of the economic and social infrastructure of the local areas, because, again, they gave voice to a view that wasn't coming from way down there in Dublin. They gave voice to a view that perhaps wasn't, you know, as official, and consequently, they were very important. Critically as well, they focused on local businesses and local opportunities and local employment, local jobs, local culture. They were a really important element in keeping some sense of a vibrant local economy in place in a very difficult situation generally.
So throughout the regions of Ireland, notably the Northwest, do you think then the businesses, when they came to marketing or advertising, they had to change their model just because pirate radio was there and that offered more opportunities for the marketing?
Well, the economics of radio and of marketing really didn't really make sense for local businesses to advertise right across the country. And in that respect, this was a dynamic new opportunity for businesses to engage in a very focused way with the people who were most important to them, the customers that were literally on their doorstep. In that respect, it offered a very important channel through which businesses could connect.
Did the pirate radio stations disrupt the media business so much that they actually left a lasting legacy on the media sector in Ireland today?
I think they did in various ways. One kind of it was a very fertile training ground for a lot of bright young journalists and disc jockeys, music producers and that. So there was an underground movement which forged a much more creative culture in this area, you know, gave a very strong alternative voice. So I think that was a very important element. And as I said, that idea of a local contact, which is hugely important. You know, they say all politics is local. You could argue that in this dimension, all business is local and all communications have to be local. So in that respect, it was a very important and dynamic addition to the local economies in what were very difficult times. So it was hugely important.
Do you think the economic impact on the leisure sector from pirate radio has largely been forgotten?
It probably has, but, you know, what it did spawn was a very vibrant local radio network, which is still very forceful in Ireland today.
Coming live from the North Sea all through the night on 259 meters medium wave, voice of Radio Caroline.
All hit radio. Laser. 558.
Pirate radio stations in Ireland in the 1980s were influenced by offshore broadcasters like Radio Caroline, which started in the 1960s and was still evading the authorities by the 80s. It had competition from Laser, broadcasting from a ship anchored in international waters in the North Sea. Laser was eventually taken over by Ray Anderson, who told me that pirate radio ships originated in the 1950s in Sweden.
Commercial radio and any sort of freedom of ownership of commercial radio was always in the hands of the government. I suppose what happened, there was this uprising of music in the 1960s. I think we discovered rock and roll coming from America. And there was a demand by the public to actually have this type of music on the radio.
We often reflect on the offshore radio stations, those in international waters broadcasting to Britain and Ireland in the 1960s. Before they were operating, there were other broadcasters in Scandinavia and eventually the Netherlands. Pirate radio wasn't confined to the UK, was it, or indeed to Ireland in the end?
Pirate radio was probably invented in the late 1950s, and I suppose the idea was to just take a ship that had been registered in a foreign country like Panama. Because the ships were in international waters, it meant that nobody from a state could legally board a ship that was foreign registered because it was in international waters. And these were the maritime rules which still are established today. And of course, it meant that people could buy a ship, get it registered somewhere convenient, and then put a transmitter on board, park yourself just outside the 3-mile limit, which it was back then, and start broadcasting. So we had stations off the coast of Sweden and a very successful Radio Nord, which transmitted into Stockholm and other parts of Sweden. And it was very successful. And then along came Radio Mercur, many other stations. And of course, because they were not government controlled, they could run all sorts of commercials. They'd run cigarette adverts. The news of this station sort of soon filtered to the Netherlands, where Radio Veronica was set up. And of course, Radio Veronica was very successful. There were a lot of advertisers. People were queuing up to put their commercials on Radio Veronica, because many of the state broadcasters in Europe were not taking adverts. Of course, it paved the way. As we got into the 60s and the 70s, other stations came along. Obviously, in England, there was probably about 10 or 12 stations on the air at one go in the UK. A lot of people that came and sort of invested in pirate radio were... The Irish were always very, very keen to put their money into this. And, of course, Americans as well. It was really an explosion which always filled the 60s with fashion and cars and entertainment. It was the decade to be somebody, to be involved with fashion or television or radio or music. It was really an incredible decade.
The veteran British disc jockey Tony Blackburn became famous as a presenter on the pirate ship Radio Caroline. And later in the 1960s, he joined the American-influenced offshore station Big L Radio London. He told me more about his radio days at sea, and he says Ireland's land-based pirates of the 1980s influenced the growth of illegal broadcasting in British cities.
I was very aware that there was a lot of pirate radio in Ireland. It was all land-based, I believe, and they set up transmitters all over the place. I thought it was great, and I thought it's, you know, I mean, I loved all that. And eventually, of course, in London and home counties, they started doing the same over here as well. I mean, we had some really good radio stations.
Do you think the choice of formats of music on air from several radio stations was a good thing for consumers or the listeners? But then a law to ban pirate radio brought an end to that area and that limited choice, maybe.
When I went to Capital Radio, and that was really the only really commercial radio station in London, it was making a fortune and there was nobody else that could challenge it in commercial radio. Whereas now, I think you do need... somebody to challenge you. You know, it's not good to have a monopoly. I mean, having said that, when I joined Radio Caroline and Big L Radio London in the North Sea, we did that to break down the BBC monopoly. And then, of course, opening up Radio 1, as I did, and the pirate ships were sort of more or less forced to close down because of the Marine Offences Bill, we created another monopoly, really, in the BBC. But it's great to be a part of a monopoly. I mean, I got up in the morning every morning and had 21 million people listening.
By the 70s, of course, the radio had developed in a smallish way privately in the UK. But compare that with Ireland. The pirates were taken off air in 1989. And within a short space of time, there was private radio spreading across the country quite legally. Do you think Ireland took lessons in Dublin from the UK?
You know, once the genie was out of the bottle, you couldn't just keep it in the bottle anymore. In Ireland, you know, they obviously wanted a more choice, and they got it. And I think that's very healthy. But it was slower to come in Ireland than it was elsewhere, yeah.
I've heard stories of being a disc jockey, a DJ on a pirate ship was just one big adventure. Sometimes I've heard tales of you climbing a tower to fix a mast, having to work in stormy conditions. Do you have a particular memory or two you can share with us?
Well, I saw that awful film, The Boat That Rocked. I hated it because there wasn't anything like what it was out there. There were no parties, there were no girls and discos and things like that. I did actually climb the Radio Caroline mast. Basically, there was something snagging on the mast, and nobody wanted to go up, and even the duck seamen didn't want to do it. So I was only 21 or 22 years old at the time, and I thought, oh, well, let's do it, get us back on the air. So I did, and I went up there, and I thought halfway up, I thought, this is stupid, what I'm doing. But I looked down, and the little boat, it looked just like a little canoe sort of thing from that height up.
What about the ship drifting in storms, dragging its anchor, things like that must have been frightening, surely?
Yeah, we always joked about the fact that eventually we would be shipwrecked somewhere, and one night it was a 10-4 scale, and Radio Caroline was a very small little boat. Norman St. John, one of the DJs on board, he came down, I was doing the breakfast show, better get up, Tony, because it looks as though we haven't got, not on the anchor anymore. And I thought he was joking. I said, oh, come on, you know, I've got to get up early tomorrow, Norman, do us a favour. But anyhow, he came back again, he said, the captain said, you really must get up, so I did. I got up and got dressed, and I went up on deck very late at night. And we had no radar or anything like that on board in those days. And we thought we were quite a long way out. And the captain shone his torch, a great big sort of light it was, and round about sort of 400 or 500 yards, there were people walking along the seafront. And he said in a very low voice, he said, Mayday. And I thought to myself, it's a bit late for that. And there was a crunching noise, and then ropes came over and they took us off by Breeches Boy.
It sounds very glamorous. Pirate radio, disturbing the whole industry, disrupting everything. But once you'd done your program, you were stuck on a ship at sea. What did you do in the spare time?
Some of us used to rewrite the news that we got from the BBC, and in a different order. And the BBC always thought we had some computer on board or something. And no, we didn't. We just rewrote what what we heard. We did get a story that put them off a little bit from the Voice of America, I think it was, and we got it before the BBC. That's why they were very suspicious.
Tony Blackburn talked about Radio Caroline simply copying the news from the BBC and other rivals. And a few years later, the early Irish pirates invested very little in news gathering. Professional journalism was out of reach for amateur broadcasters. As the columnist Malachy O'Doherty recalls, when he was appointed to compile news for a station broadcasting from a barn in South Donegal.
Maybe I hadn't understood my brief, or maybe we hadn't thought it through well enough, because we were very new to it at that time. I wasn't out as a reporter getting news, and I had no reporters working for me, going out and getting local news. So if I could get a wee bit of local gossip, I would work it in. I mean, I was reporting on international affairs. I was reporting on the politics in Dublin and Belfast. I know what I should have been doing. I can see now, looking back and listening to you. I don't think anyone was really bringing strong production values or a real vision of what the station should be. I mean, I know with the weather forecast, for instance, we used to go and just talk to a guy who lived nearby who had a reputation for being able to tell you what the weather was. John up the hill says the wind's coming from the east and it's looking a bit cloudy, so wrap up warm.
Author and political commentator Malachy O'Doherty. By the late 1980s, pirate radio broadcasters in border areas like Donegal gained huge audiences in the north.
Pirate radio in Ireland today is big business. There are now 70 pirate stations in the Republic, more than a quarter ranged along the border, beaming into Northern Ireland. But for 10 years, governments have threatened to bring the pirates to heel and done nothing.
The past 10 years in the Republic has seen a free-for-all. At the last count, there were 70 stations there. They are unlicensed, unaccountable to any broadcasting authority, and with few of the financial responsibilities of legitimate stations.
That archive recording from the BBC Northern Ireland Current Affairs programme Spotlight showed how the UK authorities were growing concerned about the outside influence. Salim McGlynn, the editor of the Finn Valley Voice newspaper in Ballybuffet, recalls that the pirates linked communities north and south.
Of all the impacts, especially with the current situation, I think that is maybe one of the key impacts of radio, because the airwaves don't recognise borders, and that the people on either side of the border can suddenly realise through arts, through music, through conversation, that there are no real differences at all.
Salim McGlynn from the Finn Valley Voice newspaper.
Get out of here, you lachico, they send me on my way.
Daniel O'Donnell admits he owes his singing career to pirate radio stations playing his records. Broadcast signals don't stop at borders, so the unlicensed stations gained huge audiences in the north. Daniel O'Donnell told me the pirates linked communities.
There were stations along the border. Oh God, I can't mind the name of them now. I'm sure it was North Sound or an Ironside. They were on the border. So they were going into, you know, the northern county, Monaghan, Cavan, but going into Fermanagh and Tyrone, I suppose even into Armagh and Antrim and, you know, County Down.
What about the possibility that because the radio stations broadcasting without a licence but were so-called pirate stations broadcasting into Northern Ireland, do you think that they actually developed an understanding, a cross-border understanding between different communities that maybe wasn't the aim of the stations, but that happened?
The thing about music is, and I always believe this, that music has no division. And I remember one time I was in Australia and I was on a television show and I was surprised because we'd never be asked about it here. I was asked about the Troubles in the North. I says, well, you know, when I am on stage, I cannot tell if somebody is a Catholic or a Protestant. And you don't know by looking at anybody. And the music is uniting, not dividing. And likewise, radio was uniting and not dividing. People were hearing the music and all denominations were coming to dances and concerts. And that was certainly one thing that was very apparent.
I recall you coming into the radio station I worked on in Buncrana. In theory, broadcasting was illegal then. We were dubbed to be pirate radio stations. When you were either doing a concert with a radio station supporting you or maybe even doing an interview in that unlicensed station, did you feel you were doing something illegal?
Never entered my head. I never even thought about it. You know, I never thought, and even to this day, it's only now that you say it, I suppose, because it was illegal. But, you know, what harm was it doing? It was actually providing a service that was not there.
Do you think it's important then that the pirate radio stations or the unlicensed stations were operating an alternative platform? Before those stations existed, you had to listen to a station in London or Dublin or Belfast. There was nothing local.
Nothing local. And see, what made the pirate radio stations, or the ones that I suppose I was aware of, is that they played country and the Irish music. That's what made them popular, and in turn they made the music popular.
So whether it's traditional music, folk music or Irish country music, that whole scene owes a debt which maybe has been forgotten to the pirate radio stations.
When I started, the pirate radio stations were huge. That's the reason that we have local radio in Ireland today.
I suppose that things have changed so much. How do you see the future, though?
Well, I think as long as radio stays local, there will be an interest in it. Because when it's local, I've noticed now in the UK, there's a lot of syndicated shows. And when we used to go to Inverness, they would talk about Inverness. But now you go to Inverness and it's the show's coming from Glasgow, or if they're doing it in Inverness, it's going out in Glasgow. So they cannot talk local.
Do you recall where you were and when it was, the circumstances, when you first heard one of your records being played on radio?
There was a station in Dublin. What was it called?
Perhaps Treble TR.
Treble TR. And I can remember one morning, I was staying with friends of mine and they had the radio on. And I remember the Latchico was on that album and it came on. Now, I obviously had the record out before, you know, Donegal Shore, but it was amazing, I suppose, just randomly to hear your record on the radio. And it's still to this day the same.
You've been listening to an analysis of the impact of pirate radio in the Northwest during the 1980s. Join me again for part three, where I shine a light on the thorny subject of payola, radio stations being paid secretly to play records.
Payola is a very, very taboo word in the United States of America, but Probably less so in Europe, because it definitely went on.
And how Pirate Radio's training ground for presenters led to amusing mistakes on air by novice broadcasters.
I'd forgotten that when you're queuing and you go on air, it turns down the music in the background. And all I could hear was this dead air. And I remember just going, oh no, what have I pressed? What's happened? And that went out on the airwaves.
I'm Russ Padmore, recalling the days of Pirate Radio in Donegal and the Northwest. Join me next time for the final episode. This programme was funded by Commissioner Mann with the television licence fee.